Bernie Sanders is being pressed on what he's going to do with the future of his presidential bid. Turns out he has other things on his mind, kind of. We're sort of in an emergency. So why don't we go to him as he responds to those concerns.
Sir, what do you say to your supporters? There have been all this flurry today. Can you say to you?
Something we said is just not true. We sent out a statement.
What's your time frame?
Stop with this. I'm dealing with a global crisis. You know, we're dealing with it. You're asking me these questions, right?
You're running for president, so...
Right now, I'm trying to do my best to make sure that we don't have an economic meltdown and that people don't die. Is that enough for you to keep me busy for tonight?
So, look, I think that might actually be the first time I've ever heard Bernie Sanders swear, let alone drop an F-bomb. But, look, if there was going to be a reason, wouldn't this be it? If there was going to be a time, wouldn't this be the time? I mean, he's trying to probably get from... that was CNN's Manoraju talking to him in the Senate hallways. He was probably going to a vote on the crisis, on dealing with this. And right now, you know, Democratic leadership is really dropping the ball, and we're going to get to that later on. But the Republicans are really messing with the effort to pass this as well. Bernie Sanders is probably engaged in a struggle against both of them. And while, of course, he's paying attention to the presidential campaign, and he's definitely going to be planning whether he's continuing or not, all of that, we're going to get to that. Right now, he's in the middle of trying to respond to this. And so it seems kind of crazy to press him over and over like that. And I think a lot of us can probably understand where he's coming from there. There was a little bit more on this, though. Initially, most people found out about this interaction with Bernie Sanders from tweets, but we were able to find the audio. But let's go to just a little bit more on this. The reporter, Manoraju, says, the blow-up occurred about halfway through a five-minute gaggle where Sanders talked about the unprecedented crisis of our lifetime, calling for a range of measures that the U.S. government should take in the midst of the economic crisis. Then Lisa Mascaro asked what he's saying to his supporters, and he sidestepped the question, noting that he sent out a statement. Then I asked about his time frame, and he was furious. Afterwards, he mailed out and answered questions about the crisis for about two more minutes. So there doesn't seem to be any acknowledgement in that he came out and his initial comments were about the crisis and the need to do something about it. And then they started peppering him with questions about the campaign, and they act as if his anger makes no sense. And then they said, we mail it out and started talking about the crisis again. But that's what he was trying to do the entire time. He was trying to address concerns about the crisis. And not just in terms of what is actually being done, but reassuring people that something is going to be done. Because I think a lot of people watching the news, seeing the squabbling back and forth, they don't necessarily have a lot of faith that their elected leaders really in either party are taking this as seriously as they should. Now, we have someone in Bernie Sanders who does take this seriously. And honestly, many of the programs that he's been advocating for, not only in these past two presidential campaigns, but for literally his entire his entire career in politics, would have put us in a much stronger position to weather this storm. And, you know, it's sort of ironic that those are the sorts of policies that are being discussed right now to get us through this crisis, this emergency, when they would have helped us with all the past emergencies that we've been dealing with. Obviously, we need to deal with this, but people have been dying needlessly and unnecessarily because they've been left behind by our healthcare system for a very long time. And so, yeah, he should be furious. He should be enraged. I think that the reporters could be a little bit more understanding about that. I saw this video, and it doesn't mean anything. It's not anything. It's just really cute. So take a look at this.
Are you a zombie?
I was woken up from a very deep sleep by some little kid who promised me a zillion, cadillion, a billion times. There was no time. And that brought about a strange change in my DNA. Now, I have become uncontrollably a monster who's gonna eat up little kids and wake me up. I see.
I like that.
The little kid who's gonna wake me up. That kid is in very deep.
So look, I'm gonna keep it real. I've never seen anything like that in my entire life. Like, Bernie Sanders is almost always on message, serious, you know, like worried. I've never seen him interact with anyone like that. Now, obviously, if he's going to, it should be with his grandson. And you could see when they pan to the grandson's face that he loves an interaction. It's just, look, I don't like sort of idealizing politicians. I don't believe in cults of personality or, you know, putting all of your expectations and hopes of the future on individuals and all of that. And part of that is sort of like you look at the way Trump supporters look at Trump and his family, and it seems nonsensical and kind of disgusting. But with Bernie Sanders, he keeps it so much about the policy, almost always, virtually never talking about himself, his own life. Like getting that brief glimpse into an interaction with a member of his family was very interesting. I'm seeing people responding in the chat. I've never seen anything like that. Have you ever seen him be cute? I don't think, other than maybe his interaction with the bird in the 2016 campaign, that's not normally a mode that he goes into. And the thing is, like a lot of the rest of us, like when he, like let's go back to the Mata Raju video. So when he gets really angry when he's trying to deal with this crisis and they're like, no, when are you going to drop out? Are you going to announce? What are you going to do? What are you going to tell your supporters? Like, he's probably thinking about that kid and the rest of the members of his family that he probably sees as being left behind by the response so far. And think about it. Whatever information you or I have about how things are going, what the government response looks like, he almost certainly has far more information. And, you know, I don't want to get too dark, but probably more reason to be worried about this, to be worried about what effect it could potentially have on a member of his family in the future. So, look, that video obviously is just for fun. But, you know, I need something like that. I follow an account on Twitter. It's Aussies Doing Things, and it's just videos of Australian shepherds being cute. I think we need stuff like that now, perhaps more than ever.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unf***ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unf***ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be. Featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity, the UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Some states have taken the coronavirus incredibly seriously, instituting closures of restaurants and bars, theme parks, concerts, all sorts of things like that. New York is obviously doing that. California has clamped down a lot. Some areas, like San Francisco, had, you know, a total effective quarantine, at least for a period. Other states, by the way, have not really been doing much and have been resistant to make any sorts of changes that hypothetically could lead to frustration on the part of some of their population or certainly could hurt tourism. Now, Florida is perhaps one of the best examples of that. I want you to take a look at a comparison video. I saw this on Morning Joe, and it's a bit of Paris, which is locked down, and Clearwater, Florida. Take a look at this.
On the left, Paris, France, yesterday, one of the world's most visited cities, turning into a virtual ghost town. The entire country currently under lockdown. And then on the right, the beaches of Clearwater, Florida, clearly in the throes of spring break, with people who are not listening to the severe warnings that scientists and doctors from the highest levels of government are trying to send them.
So you saw that video. Now, bear in mind, the video from Clearwater supposedly comes from yesterday, at most 48 hours ago. That's going to be important as we go forward because there are going to be some people in Florida government who are denying that that sort of thing still existed in the past few days. But you see, France, which has been hit hard by coronavirus, has a lot of cases, a lot of deaths, taking it very seriously. Paris is effectively a ghost town. It's much like some of the video you've probably seen of Italy, by the way, where things are being just entirely shut down, and necessarily so, if they're going to flatten the curve, get a handle on this thing. But then there's all this spring break activity, and beaches are just packed, crowds of people. Now, I'll say the shot of Clearwater right there doesn't look as packed as some scenes from Florida beaches that I've seen, but still a lot of people. And whether because they don't think that this is actually a big deal, they don't trust the information they've been given about coronavirus, or possibly just because they already planned this vacation and they're not going to waste it, like they already have the flight and the hotel, I guess they're going to go through with it. They're going out there and, in theory, possibly risking contracting coronavirus. And the thing is, up until literally today, Florida's governor, Ron DeSantis, he didn't want to make any big changes. You know, I mean, look, if the CDC is making these recommendations of crowd sizes, he might go along with that, but he wasn't doing anything. Now, thankfully, as of this morning, we have seen a shift in that. And so here is Ron DeSantis on Fox and Friends.
Have decided to close their beaches to groups, but at the same time, you're not closing the state beaches to groups of less than 10, right?
So the message, I think, for spring breakers is that the party's over in Florida. You're not going to be able to congregate on any beach in the state. Many of the hot spots that people like to go to, whether it's Miami Beach, Fort Lauderdale, Clearwater Beach, are closed entirely for the time being. The bars are closed, so you're not going to have a place to congregate there. So we would just tell those folks, you know, maybe come back next year when things are better. But that is not what we're looking for here in the state of Florida. Every single beach will have to abide by the CDC guidelines. No more than 10 people. You have to be socially distant. Not every beach is going to remain open, but some will. We have sheriff's deputies in places like Brevard County. You know, they're going to be out on ATVs, making sure there's no groups.
Okay, so that's Ron DeSantis. That's Fox and Friends. And so he's saying, yes, these big crowds on beaches are finally going to end. And like, I guess we should be happy. We should, you know, thank him for finally being reasonable, you know, in light of what we're facing. It's Thursday today, right? I don't know. I'm in quarantine. It's hard to know. It's Thursday. They should have done this days and days ago. And look, anything's better than nothing, I suppose. But that is days where it's not irrational to think that people might have congregated on those beaches, go into the bars, and maybe contracted something. And when we're trying to limit the spread, that might have given it just enough time to be worse than it could have been. He goes on to say in that video, by the way, that the video you've been seeing, people have been spreading around video. He's not talking about the Morning Joe one in particular, but he's saying video that's been spread, that's from like Saturday. That's before the CDC really clamped down supposedly on the crowd size. And I get why he would say that. He's probably being criticized quite a bit from being one of the most like recalcitrant governors in dealing with COVID-19, but it's just not true. We showed you that video. That video is from like 30 hours ago. That is not from Saturday. That is after the CDC kept clamping down from 500 to 250 to 50 to now it's something like 10 for gatherings. And so he's simply being completely dishonest there. I don't know for sure why. It could be that he's bought into the same sort of misinformation that's informed a lot of Donald Trump and Fox News' commentary about this pandemic. Maybe he just doesn't really take it seriously. Maybe he's worried about spring break. Maybe he wanted to get through as much of that as possible, make sure that the economic damage there in Florida wasn't worse. I don't know what his reasoning is, but I do know that he is, like Donald Trump, he is lying about his record on this issue. And of course, Fox and Friends, they weren't there to correct him. We're going to get to Fox and Friends in their own attempt to sort of reframe what they've been saying about this. But Ron DeSantis there is, he's effectively saying that some of these beaches are going to be shut down. Let's note that in that video, he did not say that they're all going to be shut down. And look, if you have people going around on ATVs and breaking up groups, okay, that's good. That doesn't mean that they're not still going to happen. And it's not to say that all of this is on him, but if he's been dragging his heels, if he's been lying up until now, how much faith do you have in him going forward? That Florida, which is not only a large population, but also, let's keep it real, it is an older population. On average, the population is older. It is likely that they're going to be hit harder than other states by coronavirus as it continues to spread. And he does not look like the right person to deal with that. He does not appear to be taking it seriously as of right now. Now, there are other states. I'm going to have to check in to see if maybe there's been progress today. But I know that Texas so far, another big state, quite Republican, not taking it very seriously. Like, this is a story that we've been talking about for weeks now, where Fox News and Donald Trump kept telling, week after week after week, kept telling their fans, don't take this seriously, it's just a hoax, it's not a big deal. And now some of them are starting to change their tune, but what do you know? Red states are slower to deal with this. And that's going to produce costs for their people, for their base. I worry about what the numbers could end up looking like. At some point, an analysis, a book is going to, they're going to go back, they're going to look at the numbers, and they're going to break it down based on ideology, party ID. I guarantee there's going to be an effect where more people are going to have suffered from this that identify as Trump supporters than not. Maybe we're not supposed to say that, but that's the way I see it. Fox and Friends has been the source of quite a bit of misinformation about the coronavirus in terms of what you should do about it. Now, they appear to be changing that, and they are advising people not to congregate in big groups, but that doesn't mean they're not going to use this to get in a few shots along the way. So take a look at this video. This is Nicole Safier, Fox News medical contributor, on Fox and Friends this morning.
We continue to see these spring breakers just having little care for what is going on. You know, yep. Not only as a mother of three, but my entire book, Make America Healthy Again, I talk about how bad behavior and big government has caused our trillion-dollar health crisis. This is no difference. We know that this generation, they like to take it to the streets, as AOC says. They do protests. They feel that they are invincible. Part of this is just being young and not having compassion for those older. But part of that is also their parenting as well. So they're going to force themselves into a position of martial law where we're actually going to need to quarantine them, because if they can't make good choices for the betterment of our country, then we need to separate them.
Okay, so look, she's saying that hypothetically there might need to be martial law. That appears to indicate that she's taking this very seriously. She was referring there to effectively what Ron DeSantis is responding to, these spring breakers who are getting together. You've probably seen the videos of them talking and saying that they're not very worried about this. They're certainly not going to change their plans. You know, they're going to party and have fun. They're young. It doesn't affect the young or whatever. There's a lot of myths out there that are going to do a lot of damage. And so she seems to be taking it seriously. Now, oddly, I don't know if you noticed what I noticed. What was that thing about AOC in the middle of that? That young people like think that they're invincible. And one reason is because AOC says to get out there and protest. Like, that's not just a random weird aside. There's an objective there. There's a goal there. And you're going to see this a lot now. Now that the right is theoretically taking this seriously, they need to find out who to blame for this. And especially coming off of months of not taking it seriously, of making the crisis worse than it had to be, they're going to want to divert blame wherever they can. We were talking yesterday on the show about the attempt to get people as focused on China as possible. I've seen even more of that so far this morning. Maybe we'll talk a bit more about that later. But if they can put it on the Democrats, they're going to do that too. And in the early stages, it is going to be very weird and fumbling and awkward references to AOC telling people to protest and stuff like that when there's no reasonable or logical connection there. But eventually you can expect that it will probably become a little bit more sophisticated. So right now they're trying to throw it onto her. God knows where they're going to go from there. But anyway, I do agree. I'm glad that she's taking it seriously and that she's doing it on Fox and Friends, because the Fox and Friends audience does need to catch up to the rest of the world. But the reason that they need to catch up is that they have been misinformed by Fox and Friends. And so let's turn to a little bit of this. You remember this? Fox News hosts urge viewers to fly, claiming the safest time to do it is during a pandemic, despite health officials' warnings. We talked about that on the Damage Report. That was Ainsley Earhart saying that this is the perfect time, in fact, to fly. That was 6 days ago. That was not February. That wasn't like the beginning of this. That was just before the last weekend. And I understand, I get, it's taken a long time to get people to take this seriously, but there were plenty of people who knew what was up when Ainsley Earhart was telling people to book a flight to Greece or whatever, or to hang out in LAX. But if you were watching Fox and Friends, that's what you thought going into this last weekend, that in fact, this is like the perfect time. Let me read her full quote, actually. She says, it's actually the safest time to fly. Everyone I know that's flying right now, terminals are pretty much dead. Ghost towns. First of all, maybe finesse the language a little bit when you're talking about a pandemic, but that was just last weekend. I guess they've forgotten about that. I didn't see Ainsley Earhart apologize for those comments or anything like that. But again, to be fair, it isn't just her. So let's go to Devin Nunes. We talked about this on the show as well. He was on Fox News saying there's a lot of concerns with the economy here because people are scared to go out. He's talking about California. But I will say just one of the things you can do if you're healthy, you and your family, it's great time to just go out. Go to a local restaurant. Likely, you can get in easily. Let's not hurt the working people in this country that are relying on wages and tips to keep their small business going. So don't run to the grocery store and buy, you know, $4,000 of food. Go, you know, go to your local pub. So that is a Republican congressman telling people 3 days ago that they should be going to their local pub, their local restaurant. Look, it was like right on the cusp of all of those being shut down across the state of California. So 6 days ago, you should be planning flights. You should be traveling around the country. 3 days ago, all this stuff about like quarantining and eating at home, hashtag stay at home, all that stuff. Forget that. That was just 3 days ago. And look, if they've landed on the right spot, if they've finally moved on to giving people the right advice, that will be progress. But I'm not ready to just move on and pretend that they didn't do what they did and that it won't produce, you know, potentially more cases of coronavirus, more unnecessary deaths due to it. Like, we have to remember this. I get it. We have to fix the problem. We have to come together. We have to make sure that we flatten the curve. We have to get aid to the people that need it. But we also can't forget the people that made it worse than it needed to be. And right now, across the network, Fox News hosts are pretending that they didn't say what they definitely said. I saw Sean Hannity, I think it was last night on his show. He was saying that he never referred to coronavirus as a hoax. He 100% did. It was like a week and a half ago on his show. He called it the latest cudgel to attack Donald Trump with. It's the latest hoax. And so, look, he's worried. Like all of us are, except he's worried about his reputation. He's worried about people remembering that he was on the wrong side of this. That he, like Donald Trump, perhaps because of Donald Trump, was engaged in an attempt to get people to not take this seriously up until the last possible moment. And so we're just going to note that for the record, okay? Maybe at some point there'll be some sort of consequence. I know Trish Regan, she sort of lost her show. They're saying it's not because she was calling it a hoax, but it seems weird that she's the one out of all of them when she had... like I would say the least extreme out of Laura Ingraham, Sean Hannity, all of that. Tucker Carlson doesn't deny that it's real, but he is trying to get you to focus all of your anger against the Chinese people. And it's weird that she's the one that suffered consequences as a result of it. I feel like we should note that. The big news of the morning in the Democratic primary race was that Tulsi Gabbard is suspending her campaign. And at the time that she's doing that, she's also doing an endorsement. So here is Tulsi Gabbard.
Throughout my life and throughout this campaign, my motivation has been to serve God, our country, and the American people as best I can. I feel that the best way that I can be of service at this time is to continue to work for the health and well-being of the people of Hawaii and our country in Congress, and to stand ready to serve in uniform should the Hawaii National Guard be activated. Now, after Tuesday's election, it's clear that Democratic primary voters have chosen Vice President Joe Biden to be the person who will take on President Trump in the general election. I know Vice President Biden and his wife, and I'm grateful to have called his son, Beau, a friend who also served in the National Guard. Although I may not agree with the vice president on every issue, I know that he has a good heart and he's motivated by his love for our country and the American people. I'm confident that he will lead our country guided by the spirit of aloha, respect and compassion, and thus help heal the divisiveness that has been tearing our country apart. So today, I'm suspending my presidential campaign and offering my full support to Vice President Joe Biden in his quest to bring our country together.
Okay, so look, I think a lot of people were really shocked by that. They were not expecting this to happen. Tulsi had given every indication that she planned to continue her race, you know, to the convention or whatever. Look, depending on whether you were a supporter of her, your understanding about why that was is probably different. I would say she was pretty clearly running not because she thought that she could become a president, not at least in the last couple of months. I mean, there was no chance of that. But I would say, I think that the best interpretation is she was doing it to continue to elevate issues that she cared about. I think that that's a fairly fair way to describe it. But she is ending it. And there's a couple of potential reasons for that. It could be the coronavirus. It's much harder for her to actually campaign. Obviously, basically all the campaigns are effectively only doing remote sort of gatherings and, you know, digital addresses, things like that. And so she can't even continue to that extent. It could be that she understands that the probability that she's going to get coverage when she talks about the issues that she cares about is probably just about nil in this media environment. So probably all of that and more is combining to her changing her calculus on staying in the race, and so she will be dropping out. Now, swirling around all of that, though, aside from just her decision to leave, is... man, Twitter has been a bad place in relation to this. Like, look, I'm being completely upfront. In the same way that I was about Andrew Yang when he dropped out, I wasn't a supporter of Andrew Yang. I was not a supporter of Tulsi Gabbard. But I will say there are some people who I think were supporters of Tulsi Gabbard who were responding on Twitter sort of negatively to her dropping out and endorsing Biden. And there's multiple different ways that you could sort of be angry about that. So let's break them all down. So there are a lot of people like me who are fans of Bernie Sanders who think, look, if you're going to endorse someone, you could endorse Bernie Sanders, or you could not endorse at all. You could do that rather than endorsing Biden. So a lot of the left is going to be very angry about this because she's not only choosing to endorse when she could at the very least sit out, if not endorse Bernie, but to endorse Biden just... it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense based on the issues that she's made the core of her campaign. I mean, look, from her point of view, her race is about anti-interventionism. She's anti-war, all of that. I think it's obviously a little bit more nuanced than that, but that certainly has been sort of the core narrative of her campaign. And Joe Biden, out of the remaining two, he is the Iraq war guy. He certainly is more likely as president to engage in, you know, intervention of a variety of different sorts than Bernie Sanders would. So if you were going to endorse someone just to get your message out, it seems like it would make more sense for Bernie Sanders. The race is not done. I mean, look, Bernie could drop out. He could. I'm not saying that it's not possible. I was shocked by this. I could be shocked by that. But to endorse Biden, it doesn't make sense from an ideological perspective. If you look at the entirety of the primary campaign, it makes a little bit more sense. Like many people have noted throughout this campaign that she was incredibly hands-off with Joe Biden. And the same thing that leads me to wonder why she would endorse someone who was, you know, in support of the Iraq war and other conflicts. Like, why wasn't she raising that at the debates? Why wasn't she talking about that? There were months and months where he was the front runner and she had no interest. In fact, at one point, defended him from criticisms of his vote on the war in Iraq. There was even that period where, at sort of like, you remember, at each debate, she was sort of taking on like the person that was rising in the polls. Like, it was Elizabeth Warren once, it was Kamala Harris, I mean, it might have been Buttigieg at one point. But across none of that did she go after Joe Biden. And that stood out to a lot of people. Like, we could disagree about why exactly she was doing that. I know some people think that she wants to be his VP. I personally don't think that she thinks that that's a possibility. But after a campaign of not attacking like the guy who is most emblematic of what you're trying to fix in politics, I guess to endorse him in the end is less shocking. Now, I know some people were rightfully pointing out that, like, according to Hillary Clinton's logic, where she is only in this to sort of sway people in the way that, like, Russia wants or whatever. Like, I saw there was a super chat, Andrew Dwyer was like, Biden has a Russian asset supporting him now, I think pointing out that sort of narrative that they had been pushing. Then this doesn't really make a lot of sense. Like, the only argument that would allow that to continue is to say, well, in a primary that's still going on, hypothetically, Putin would be more in support. But that's just nonsense. No, I guess that she thinks that he has the best chance, that she's looking at the math, I guess. In the end, it's going to leave a lot of Bernie Sanders supporters really frustrated. I mean, not only that that she continued this run for so long when clearly she wasn't going to win and was probably taking, you know, a point or two away from Bernie Sanders, but never endorsed him, even though, you know, hypothetically she agrees with him on a lot of the issues. That's going to be really frustrating. And so a lot of the reaction is going to be similar to with Andrew Yang, I think. I know I tweeted once about this and people got mad at me. They were like, why'd you attack Andrew Yang but not Tulsi? Look, I honestly, I feel pretty similar about the two of them. It doesn't really make sense that they would endorse him unless it is just, I want to have access and influence, that I care about, you know, anti-interventionism, or I care about UBI, and I think that Biden's going to be the nominee, and so I want an in with him later. Maybe it's just cold, hard, you know, political math or pragmatism or something like that. I don't know. We can disagree with it, but I'm just trying to explain where they're potentially coming from. I do want to say, though, some people are, like, shocked that she's dropping out endorsing Biden. These are people who hated her. Most of them are probably Biden's supporters. This is sort of the Hillary camp. They're, like, shocked that she is going to endorse the Democrat, that she's not running as a third-party candidate. And while I disagree, you know, I disagree with her quite a bit on a number of different things, like, I've been defending her in that area for a long time. Let's just go briefly to this. So this video, Tulsi 100% won't run a third party candidacy. Yeah, that was on the Damage Report. That was back in November of last year. And I laid out all of the evidence that the people, including Hillary, who were saying she's in this to cause chaos, and at some point she's going to drop out and run a third party candidacy to try to get Donald Trump elected. There's just not a lot of reason to believe that. She had been incredibly clear and consistent on the record saying, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to support the Democrat. Just like Bernie, she said it over and over and over and over again, and no matter how many times she said it, they would always come back with asking the question again. And it's that old school tactic of, they're not asking the question to find out the answer, they're asking the question to imply that you haven't been clear. It's an attack, not a query, basically, at that point. But no, she had done any number of interviews saying, in the end, she's going to support the eventual nominee. Now, that does not mean that she had to endorse Biden here. Like, she could have not endorsed. The race is still going on. There are still two other candidates in this. And so if you, like me, are, you know, you're on the left, you're a Bernie Sanders supporter, you're totally right to potentially be mad about this. But the fact that she is going to endorse someone at some point, I don't know why the centrists are so shocked by that. I guess they're blinded by the sort of the narrative, the view that they had concocted of who she was. But she was always saying that. And by the way, I'll say what I said in that video. You can go back and watch that video. It's still on the channel. She supported Hillary Clinton in 2016 in the general election. So did Bernie. And both of them are being very clear in 2016 and 2020 that they're eventually going to support the candidate. Tulsi Gabbard is not an independent. She is a Democrat. I can't say what will happen in the future, but she supported the party's nominee in 2016. She's doing that right now. And some people are like, I guess, just trying to be amazed by this when it's incredibly consistent with what she's been saying she's going to do. By the way, I see Mind of the North Star wrote a super chat saying this was the anti-war candidate that wouldn't attack Biden on his Iraq vote. This endorsement is no surprise. Also, Anna was right about her. Look, again, it might have been that the whole time she was thinking there's the possibility, like I said, of being his VP or maybe being in his cabinet or something like that. There's probably still at least some small chance of that, I guess. Maybe that's why she didn't do it. I would say that of all of the ways that she could try to take someone down, and she had multiple attempts, and some of them more successful than others. I think her attacks against Kamala Harris were quite effective. There was no, like, it was just teed up for her against Joe Biden. And honestly, like, as a Bernie Sanders supporter, what if she had? What if she had made a big deal out of his support for the war in Iraq back in July or August of last year? Could that have had an effect? Maybe. Biden wasn't, but he was in first. He had a big lead. Now, he eventually did go down. It's possible that the same sort of consolidation of the centrists would have happened, but it could have had some effect. I don't know. Maybe we'll never know. But anyway, she's moving on. The question, I think, will be at this point, if she does, so she endorsed Biden, if she supports Biden, campaigns for him, will she be able to get some of her fans to support Biden? That will be interesting to see. I guess that will be what she'll be going for. And I know that she's spent a lot of time on Fox News. They've given her, you know, a platform. Maybe she'll be able to bring over some of those, like, you know, like Republicans who aren't huge Trump supporters. I guess if Biden does accept this endorsement, which as of our filming, he has not, that will probably be the reason. But we'll have to wait to find out. It's time to take out the trash. So this is garbage, people. I've got my trash can here. It's not the one from the studio, although maybe I'll go and get that because I anticipate that we're probably going to have a lot of garbage to deal with in the near future. So we've got our little trashy here. It's been stocked up with some people who've been horrible recently, and we've got a lot more for you. So because this is our first lockdown edition garbage, people, I wanted to give you a few. And what do you know? The universe has delivered. So first, we have Republican Senator Ron Johnson. Take a look at what he said recently. I'm not denying what a nasty disease COVID-19 can be. By the way, that's a great start to a paragraph. But he goes on to say, and how it's obviously devastating to somewhere between 1 and 3.4% of the population, but that means 97 to 99% will get through this and develop immunities and will be able to move beyond this. But we don't shut down our economy because tens of thousands of people die on the highways. It's a risk we accept so we can move about. We don't shut down our economies because tens of thousands of people die from the common flu. Getting coronavirus is not a death sentence, except for maybe no more than 3.4% of our population, and I think probably far less. Whoa. Any one of those sentences probably would have resulted in you being in the trash. So I'm gonna put him in there for right now, and here's why. If 3.4% of our population dies, that's millions of people. He's talking about it as if it's some sort of silver lining that only 3.4% might die. No, that's horrendous. And if we have to take drastic actions to make sure that that doesn't happen, that nothing even approaching that happens, I think that's the reasonable thing to do. I'm going to extend a lot of goodwill to the American people and say that they probably agree with me, that that's probably the reasonable thing to do. But this is a senator telling people, just get used to the idea that millions are going to die, honestly. Like, are we really going to damage the economy over that, over millions of deaths? That's honestly, that feels a bit like what Donald Trump has been saying, the over-concern for Wall Street and the strength of the economy, quote-unquote, rather than worrying about the American people, about actual people. And by the way, he says there, it's a horrible analogy too. We don't shut down the economy because tens of thousands of people die on the highways. Yeah, that's true. Well, first of all, this is many, many times that. But more importantly, we have introduced how many different attempts to stop that from happening? We have, you know, we have laws of the road. We have speed limits. We have regulations for safety in automobiles. We do many things to make sure that less people die on the highways. And bear in mind, back in the day, there were elected representatives who were against those sorts of measures, who didn't think that you should have to wear your seatbelt, that there shouldn't be speed limits and those sorts of things. That same sort of ignorance, that continues in senators like the now the Republican senator of the trash can, Ron Johnson. But he's not the only one. Okay, we're gonna put some other people in there. Okay, I'm ready for this one. Okay, let's see. Okay, we got Don Young. Okay, Don Young, why does he belong in there? Well, Don Young skipped a vote on the coronavirus relief bill to go to an NRA fundraiser. And then he went to a senior center and started making jokes about the coronavirus, calling it the beer virus. And he told people, this is just last weekend, at that senior center, go forth with everyday activities. Put him in there. Seniors who are in a place designed to provide quick access to healthcare for them, which we know have already been devastated in some places. Washington had outbreak of coronavirus that killed many at one of these sorts of centers. He goes there after raising money from the NRA and tells people, don't listen to this stuff about self-quarantine. Just go about your regular day. Go to shuffleboard, play some poker, do some bingo, whatever. This is what we have. This is what we're dealing with. Senators and representatives who fundamentally do not take this seriously. And they're not the only ones. This is Representative Andy Biggs. So he voted against the Families First Coronavirus Response Act. Do you want to know why? Well, he did an interview on Monday with the conservative Christian group, the Family Research Council, and he say he voted against it on Saturday because it included provisions for domestic partnerships, including same-sex relationships. So look, it's not that he's against the bill or against helping the American people, but it talks about gay relationships. That is a line too far for Andy Biggs when it comes to making sure that people don't die, that those who are losing their jobs, businesses are shutting down, that we get relief to those people. It's not that he doesn't care about that. It's that he just cares about discriminating against the LGBT community a little bit more at this point. But you know what? That's, what's that, three people that we've just put in there? I think there's probably more room, I think. So let's put a whole bunch of people. Republican senators on Wednesday teamed up to kill an amendment introduced by Democratic Senator Patty Murray that would have expanded paid sick leave to millions of U.S. workers left out of a bipartisan coronavirus relief package. Every Republican present for the vote, 51 in total, voted against the amendment, while every Senate Democrat voted in favor. Look, I'll have words for the Senate Democrats in just a minute, but I think we need to put, can you see this? I don't know if you can see this. That's all of them. So they had an issue with expanding paid sick leave to more workers. Now, they have passed a bill that includes paid sick leave, but is for a very small percentage of the population. People who are directly impacted by coronavirus, businesses of a certain level, but not bigger. And the attempt to just expand it, like we have to do something about this. No, they are still splitting hairs on the size of the business and those sorts of things. Again, they care, just not as much as they care about business interests, I guess. So let's put the entirety of their caucus in there. Man, the trash can is going to be really full in like a week. But by the way, let's also note that they are not the only ones who belong in there. Look, I guess it's, you're not supposed to say this, it's unpopular, whatever. But what's going on with the Democratic Party right now? Other than a few individuals who do seem to be taking this seriously, we've called out a few, we will more in the future. The lack of passion for this, the lack of like speed on this is just shocking. Like, first of all, morally, this is the biggest crisis that they have been faced with in many years, and thus the drive to do something about it should be bigger than anything else. But instead, you've got like Nancy Pelosi is like holding up the relief package to say that we need to means test to make sure that these checks aren't going to people who hypothetically might be able to get by without them. Look, I understand you wanted to keep the price tag down, I guess, but people are suffering now. And like, again, I don't want to go too far with this, but Donald Trump, whether he actually supports the sorts of things he's saying or whether he actually goes through with it, in terms of rhetoric, is seeming more compassionate, more filled with empathy, honestly, more progressive on this issue than at least what Nancy Pelosi is projecting to the country. And I think that people are going to see that. Look, and so if morally, if you're not, you know, you don't have the kick in the ass to do something about this, how about pragmatically, politically? This is a crisis, both objective and made worse by Donald Trump's rhetoric and his lack of action, the fact that he wasted literally months. This is an opportunity to both do what is right and to have the country see that you're doing what is right. And they're wasting that opportunity. They're allowing Mitt Romney to seem like a progressive when he's the one, you know, out in front talking about UBI. Now, that's not to say that there aren't a lot of Democrats who are supporting that. Certainly there are. And Bernie Sanders' plan goes way further than the rest of these. That's why he does not belong in the trash. But the Democrats have got to get together, and they've got to come together in terms of their messaging and their priorities. They are bungling this opportunity. It is definitely going to end up hurting many, many people, lots of whom probably identify as Democrats. And so, look, there's some individuals that have gone above and beyond in terms of belonging in that trash can. But right now, the vast majority of our elected representatives still, no matter what they say when they do interviews, they are fundamentally not taking this seriously. All of the little like roadblocks and the little, I worry about this. Hey, let's take it easy because we got to deal with this. All of that stuff shows that they might want you to believe that they're taking it seriously, but that's not what I'm seeing. As the government begins to respond to COVID-19, the question will be, how do the states respond? How do different elements of the federal government respond? And one that hasn't necessarily had a great track record over the past few years is Customs and Border Patrol. And we have very little information about how exactly they will function under pandemic emergency conditions. What little information we have was actually brilliantly revealed in a recent article by Ken Klippenstein, friend of the show, who joins us now to talk a little bit about what he was able to find. Ken, as always, thank you for joining us.
Great to be with you.
So to start off, tell me, where were you able to get this information from, and what's the basic takeaway from it?
Well, I have a number of sources within the Department of Homeland Security, and when you know I saw this coronavirus come about, I thought, oh, well, they probably have a policy for that. So I spoke to some of my sources, and they were able to find the most recent one, which actually goes back quite a bit. It was produced under the Bush administration after a number of executive orders he issued, many about the war on terror, but then some also about what to do in the event of a pandemic. And that actually gives the executive branch quite a lot of power, which I think the document illustrates nicely.
And so from what I read from reading your article, like we're talking about how far CBP might go. And at least hypothetically, it looks like they can go quite far. I mean, there was one thing I wanted to read. Let's see. Due to the distance from CDC quarantine stations, some CBP locations will require areas designated for medical segregation to safely detain travelers. You have references to tent cities with portable latrines. It seems like they theoretically could go pretty far.
Oh, yeah, extremely far. And that's the most interesting part of the story, is that the document illustrates what essentially is exists in arcane national security law, established, by the way, by George W. Bush. That's the administration under which this document was produced. It remains in effect and is the most recent one that we have now. But after 9/11, George W. Bush issued executive orders granting the executive branch all these powers in the case, of course, as we know, in cases of terror, you know, terrorist attacks, things like that, but also in the case of pandemics. And that didn't get very much attention because until now, with the exception of perhaps this, you know, swine flu and you know, a few things like that, that fortunately were sort of headed off before they got to the point of catastrophe. I think for that reason, we never had a whole lot of public discussion about what these powers look like and what they mean. And I think we're going to find out very imminently what they mean because we haven't been able to stop this. And so what I'm describing here, it's called quarantine law. It's a very obscure part of law that's not discussed very much. What's interesting about it is that the legal experts say that it is, I believe, unique in, you know, U.S. domestic law in terms of giving authorities the power to detain someone who has not actually committed a criminal offense. So if you have, you know, coronavirus, that's not like you broke a law or anything. However, they can still detain you. And what's interesting with this document is it's not clear how long they can detain you for. And Border Patrol specifically is going to have an important role in enforcing this, not just at the ports of entry, but remember that legally Border Patrol has authority for miles and miles in from the border. And of course, you know, the U.S. is, you know, one big border. And
it's so a lot of border.
Yeah. And there's a lot of big cities within the vicinity of, you know, oceans and those borders. So, you know, at least in principle, they have the authority to detain people suspected of these illnesses, because bear in mind, they don't have the expertise to actually diagnose these things. They're supposed to work in tandem with the CDC to carry this stuff out. And that to me seems like a recipe for at least concern, given what we know about this administration and how they're willing to exercise, you know, executive authorities.
So as you said, initially this was back in 2007. This is not even Barack Obama, it's pre-Barack Obama. It doesn't appear to have been updated or amended yet for coronavirus. Do we have any reason to believe that it is internally being updated, or that at some point we might have clarification on how the current situation might be impacting how they'll go forward in this?
Well, yeah, I was amazed that they hadn't updated it, since the avian flu, it still contains, you know, a number of references to that. And when I asked my sources why that is, what they're describing now is just a state of chaos. And it sounds as though they react to problems as they come about. There's very little in the way of sort of proactive planning. So that's why the document looks like what it does. And unfortunately, that I think is going to characterize the response. And I think that is why we haven't seen yet the exercising of some of these authorities, because it's sort of like, you know, a chicken running with its head cut off. It's just sort of Trump is saying, oh, the coronavirus is a hoax. Oh, now we have to do this. We got to do that. It just seems very incoherent. So we may be waiting a while yet until we see exactly what the full extent of the response is.
Yeah. And so you obviously, like, you've been covering CBP for some time. Many of our conversations are about either ICE or CBP. So if we now have reason to believe that their authority is quite broad and vaguely defined at best, based on your experience, I sort of know what the answer to this is going to be, but how much faith do you have for them to wield vague but expansive powers in a time where people are freaking out? You know, what do you think about their ability to handle that new authority and responsibility?
Well, I don't have to speculate, because the document itself, and it's like 300 pages long, so there's quite a lot of content in there. At one point, it describes It describes that DHS itself, the parent agency of Border Patrol, anticipates that their own staff is going to suffer from fear, and kind of describing countermeasures for how to you know ameliorate that. And unfortunately, it doesn't describe exactly what that fear is. And so, you know, that can mean a number of different things. Is this going to be a xenophobic response to migrants, which, by the way, the president has repeatedly asserted are bringing, quote, diseases in and things like that? Is that fear of our own citizenry? Is that fear of catching the illness, which, you know, is more understandable, but is still going to have consequences? They don't say, but they do stress that morale on the part of CBP, fear and them to, you know, carry out what they've been tasked with doing is going to be extremely difficult. That's what the document finds. And I think that's probably a rational inference to kind of draw.
Yeah. Well, I guess as always the case, I mean, thank you for keeping watch on them, especially like you found that document at exactly the right time for people to start to raise concerns that hopefully we'll get some sort of reassurance from the government. But thank you for that.
Well, thanks for talking to me about it, John. I wish more folks were looking at this angle. It would seem to be important.
I wish as well. So against the advice of many people, multiple states went forward with their primary elections earlier this week, and we know sort of how that went. Now, some people who worked in Florida for the Bernie Sanders campaign, volunteers, are saying that the context of coronavirus obviously had a big impact and might have shifted the election in a significant way. Joining us now to discuss this possibility is Ken Klippenstein from The Nation. Ken, welcome to the show.
Good to talk to you, John.
Always glad to have you on. We'd do every show with you if we could, but you have this like full-time job that you have to do. So talk to me about your most recent article.
So part of the Florida, you know, primary, and I think the elections generally in light of coronavirus that I think have gotten sort of short shrift has been what effect has coronavirus had on turnout, but not general turnout, which is how it's often described, but specific to each campaign, because every campaign is being carried out differently. Bernie Sanders' campaign has a pretty unorthodox approach and a very heavy reliance on things like door-to-door canvassing, rallies. You know, these huge rallies that probably when they think of his style of campaigning. What effect that the illness might have on that particular type of campaigning as opposed to something like a campaign that relies heavily on ad buys and commercials or name identification, those sorts of things. And so in order to get a sense of all this, I flew down to Florida. I talked to a pro-Bernie advocacy group that's not actually formally affiliated with the campaign. The reason I chose this group is because they have a lot more freedom to sort of talk about what this stuff looks like, even though they're doing essentially the same things as the formal campaign. They're just operating on a volunteer basis. Receive orders from the campaign, they're not. And the sense that I got from them is that coronavirus is going to really will have really hurt Sanders' campaign in particular. And I think a lot of the arguments that they advance to sort of make that case is persuasive. And I wish that had gotten more attention in the media.
So we know that the campaigns for some time now have had to radically scale back, like knocking on doors and things like that. Like interacting directly with individuals is going to affect the candidates. You know, they can't like shake a bunch of hands, but it probably has a far more significant impact on a regular volunteer where one of the most effective things you can do is go around knocking on doors, talking to people. I'm assuming that must have virtually vanished in the run up to the election.
Absolutely. That's literally what happened, not just on the part of the formal campaign, but again, these volunteers, and I have to imagine, you know, other volunteers like them. They described to me having knocked 10,000 doors just prior to coronavirus, and they were going to do another 10,000 doors. There was a kind of picture of a thermometer showing the mercury at 10,000. They were going to hit the other 10,000. They had to just cancel that second half. So, you know, what exactly that means, you know, we are limited to speculation, but I can imagine knocking on twice as many doors. 10,000 doors is going to have some kind of effect.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because this campaign, I mean, there's so much empirical evidence for that. Their supporters have a higher degree, at least in the past, you know, when this data was available, a higher degree of enthusiasm for that candidate. So I would think that a lot of these supporters are going to be the ones willing to actually do this sort of, I'm sorry, did it cut out for a moment?
No, I think you're good.
Okay. sorts of supporters are going to be willing to do this door-to-door stuff that, you know, is really sort of rigorous. It takes a lot of time and commitment. So I can't imagine that this was like a one-to-one effect.
Yeah.
Campaigns. Now, again, I'm not saying it doesn't, you know, suppress turnout generally, but I would imagine that the amount of turnout that it suppresses is going to reflect the nature of each of the campaigns. And these are quite, especially in the Sanders campaign, that's quite an idiosyncratic approach to campaigning.
Yeah, and obviously, like, surrogates and representatives can't probably fly down there and do this sort of stuff as well, so that hurts. And I get this is probably pointless to ask, but in terms of the effect of canceling massive rallies, that seems like it'll be very unequal between the two top candidates there.
Oh, yeah, I had this described to me repeatedly by, you know, different volunteers saying, like, everyone was really excited that they, you know, had talked to and had expressed interest in Sanders to go and see the rally that he was going to give. I think with the AFL-CIO is supposed to be a sort of discussion slash debate about state of you know, working conditions and wages. And then I was told, quote, the wind really came out of our sails once that was canceled. And they weren't critical of Sanders for canceling it. They understood that that was the case. But that is just a different character than the type of rally that someone like Biden might hold. Someone like Biden who, you know, gets, I'm sorry, better, you know, treatment in mainstream media outlets.
You don't have to be sorry to say that. That's totally true.
Sorry. I'm sorry to any viewers who may not want to accept that fact, but that's how it is. And that was told to me repeatedly, and it, you know, it makes sense.
Yeah. So, look, it's impossible for us to say how big of an impact this might have had, but I know you did a little bit of speculation in your article about how, look, previously, there had been periods where Biden was not polling. His advantage wasn't nearly as high as it ended up being in the results, right?
Right. Yeah, what was interesting about it, and, you know, I want to be fair, like, probably a lot of this, I it's really hard to know what effect something like coronavirus had on any sort of granular level. But his numbers did seem to shoot up after Super Tuesday, and then also after South Carolina, when he got a ton of really, you know, positive press coverage. But again, that sort of overlaps with my point, which is that when you can't have people canvassing door to door and having these face-to-face sort of very organic interactions, which I think characterize the Sanders campaign, what are people left to look to for a narrative about what's going on? And that's, you know, cable news, that's TV, that's mainstream media.
Totally.
Which, also empirical evidence for that, you know, helps Biden quite a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess one last question, when you were talking with these individuals, with these organizations, was there noticeable anger at the state and at the Democratic Party for going forward with the elections, considering what was going on?
Oh, absolutely. And there was quite a bit of dissension. I talked to some union members, too, who were furious at that their unions. I think they were realistic enough to know the unions aren't going to say, whoa, let's all go with Bernie. But they had hoped that they would play a little bit more neutral of a role. And they felt as though they were just sort of, you know, putting their foot on the accelerator for whatever might benefit Biden, and not just specific to Bernie, but there seemed to be a lot of sincere concern about if on their part about if Biden is going to be able to achieve the turnout levels necessary to defeat an incumbent, because running against an incumbent is quite different than, you know, two fresh nominees running for an election, because they don't have the sort of campaign institutions in place for re-election that someone like Trump already has.
Yeah, yeah. If I was a volunteer, if I was a poll worker, I would be furious about the fact that they went forward, especially when multiple states are like, no, of course we're not going to do that. To see some choosing not to and others like that, just go ahead with it. That's got to be worse than frustrating.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I mean, these were, you know, sensible. A lot of people I talked to, the Sanders supporters, were sensible in terms of being pragmatic. It was clear to me that a lot of them are going to, you know, vote for Biden and hope that Biden will defeat Trump. The frustration seemed pretty, you know, sincere and not sort of rooted in necessarily wanting to, like, blow up the party, just wanting to defeat Trump, you know? So I think that's sort of a mischaracterization a lot of people get. Oh, Sanders supporters don't really care about that. Wasn't at all what I saw. But.
Yeah. Well, thank you, as always, for your reporting. Really appreciate it. You know, considering that people are going to have a lot of time, probably at home in the near future, on social media, where can they follow you on social media?
Oh, I'm on Twitter, @KenKlippenstein.
Okay, everybody, follow him. We're hoping at some point he's going to resume his practice in the morning of getting us going with an affirmation on Twitter. But you're going to want to follow him just in case that happens. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you.
So I've been responding day by day to what I'm seeing in both the Trump administration in terms of some possible relief for those being negatively impacted by COVID-19, and also hoping for more out of Congress. But both Democrats and Republicans have given me a lot to be frustrated with. But for more of this conversation, I'm very excited to get the opinions of Ken Klippenstein, who joins us once again. Ken, thank you for joining us.
Hey, quite happy to give you my opinions.
Always happy to have you here. Very much appreciate your writing recently at The Nation. So, you've been watching this, and you're in D.C., by the way, so it's a very different experience than me. I'm over cloistered in L.A. What's it like out there?
It's a ghost town. As you can imagine, there are a lot of people that work for either federal government or associated agencies, so I think that they're probably a lot more proximity to the sort of information of what exactly is going on, how serious this is. And I just came back from Florida, where I was doing a story for The Nation, and the attitude seemed quite different. It does seem as though there is anxiety commensurate with the threat here, far more so than what I saw in Florida. So let the record show that whatever the officials are saying, the way they're living, at least as I can tell, and I live on Capitol Hill, they seem very scared, and they do appear to be practicing social distancing and those sorts of things quite.
Yeah. Especially, I'm sure, since we found out, I think it was yesterday, that two members of Congress have now tested positive for coronavirus. And it reminds me a little bit of, Fox News. They seem to have finally gotten their stuff together on this, but there was a period where they had been totally denying that it was anything, to then still denying that it was anything, but we found out that they were being advised internally that they were going to be cutting non-essential personnel and those sorts of things. So it's like there's a difference between what they say and what they do. So in terms of the response, you've been seeing, I'm sure, these daily briefings by the president. And what do you think about so far his ability or willingness to take this seriously?
Well, there seems to be one transcendent concern here, and that is the health of the stock market and finance and the wealthy generally. And I don't think that you have to speculate very far to see that that's why he wanted really not to say that there was a problem for as long as he did, because it's very clear that the stock market took a dip after that, that this is going to have an effect on consumption and consumer demand. So to me, that is the proper frame of the story here, is that the government and the Trump administration decided to put Wall Street ahead of everyone else, basically, and dithered for weeks and weeks, and only responded at a point in time in which it now appears as though it's going to be too late to shut down spread virus. And, again, whatever they say, I know quite a few Republican Congress people that are in private asking for these tests and getting them and taking this as seriously as any one of us or anybody on the left or anything like that. So it is pretty disheartening to see, concern for really your fellow people not take precedence over concern about economic.
Yeah. And so there's been a lot of concern about, obviously, the Republicans I'm going to have a little bit less faith in. Theoretically, we should be able to expect that the Democratic Party would take this more seriously. But there's, Nancy Pelosi is like talking so much about how we need means testing for this like version of UBI that we might put out. But people are, I think, rightfully worried that that could involve a longer delay when people need help right now. Do you think that the Democratic Party understands potentially not only how they're delaying might hurt the actual, like, substantively help people who need help, but also is providing this opportunity for the Republican Party, which in Donald Trump has completely bungled this thing for literally months, to step in and seem like leaders on this issue?
Yeah, it's scary. Anyone familiar with history knows what happens when you take the sort of nationalism that you would associate with the Trump administration and marry that with elements of socialism. Not good things down that road, because these sort of left-wing policies are going to put money in people's pockets. That's going to be extraordinarily popular, regardless of whatever the sort of cultural, someone like Trump may be. So I think that's extraordinarily dangerous and something I really hope that the Democrats are able to take the mantle on, because these are more reflective of their constituency. I mean, they're supposed to represent organized labor. They're supposed to represent workers just on a constituent basis, in a manner different from Republican Party. So, yes, that's very concerning because he does that. And I think you're going to see his numbers dramatically change. And as you pointed out, means testing things, you know, maybe you make it so that some relatively privileged people don't get as much as someone else. But the effect of that is it's a headache and a bunch of paperwork and stuff. This is an emergency. I don't think that elected officials should be worrying about if people are going to cross their T's and dot their I's properly. We should just get stuff to people. Who cares if some gets to people that don't necessarily need it, just as long. I'd rather give stuff to people who don't need it too much and make sure that everyone has something rather than, you know, potentially just to make sure that someone who doesn't get it.
Yeah. I don't know in terms of how far your contacts go into the Dem leadership right now, but do they seem to be getting that they're fumbling this thing, or do they think that so far their response has been like acceptable or popular?
My impression is that this is the same sorts of stuff they've always been saying. This has been the debate on the part of the Democratic establishment around Medicare for All. You know, the line, you know, I don't think rich people should have free healthcare. So this is like, I don't think this goes beyond how egregious their sort of hand-wringing over, you know, some imaginary billionaire going to a public hospital or something. This isn't out of character for them. However, it's the context in which this is happening that makes it really stark, which is a lot of people could die if they don't respond to this rapidly. Noticing how sort of ghoulish I think a lot of attitudes are in the face of crisis, where maybe people just kind of zone it out and just kind of speak when you're talking about it in a more, you know, in a sense, abstracted from any sort of immediate crisis.
Yeah. You know, what other thing, maybe this is random. What do you think about the sort of apparent rise of Andrew Yang to like the center of the political conversation, that now that pretty much everyone's like, well, yeah, obviously UBI, we can talk about like what form it's going to come in, how long it's going to last, but obviously we're going to do UBI.
Yeah, it sort of exposes as a lie this idea that we were never able, or, you know, or even anyone, because we should remember lack of healthcare access is something that affects shocking wealthy segments of society as well, or affluent segments of society. So, yeah, the government can always just create stimulus, help people. What's different now is that the situation is so dire that they're under pressure to do so because the economy is going to implode if they don't. But as for UBI, I wish there was a little bit more nuanced talk about it, because there's UBI as a concept, and then there's Yang's particular version of it, which would contain within it cuts to social safety net and, you know, social programs that I think make it not worth it. But I think the devil's in the details here. The question is not, do we do UBI? The question is, what kind of UBI are we going to pursue? Are we going to leave our social programs intact, or is it going to be some sort of grand bargain of the sort that Obama tried to pass, where in exchange for some assistance, you're giving up a lot of the sort of victories of the labor movement over the last several decades?
Yeah, so far I haven't heard any references to that part of it. Mostly it's about figuring out how long it's going to last, whether it's for individuals, how much it's going to be, whether kids get something. But I guess we'll see. He had tweeted yesterday that his phone was blowing up, that everyone was calling to talk to him about UBI. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I hope that people treat him as a sort of I wish he got credited as sort of getting the idea out as a meme and not necessarily on the specifics of it, because I don't think his particular approach to it was great. But it should people think about this as a sort of possibility now.
Yeah. Well, as always, Ken, thank you so much. You're right there in the thick of it. Keep yourself safe, but we appreciate you joining the show, and hopefully you can continue to do that as the lockdown continues.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.